action in working out the political and economic options for the future of Alaska Natives. Part of this is due to the fact that the state is simply going to have more financial resources available to it than the federal government is going to do to vote to devote to Alaska's specific problems. And the other is simply that Alaskan priorities will, over the long term, get lost in Washington as they have in the past, and that it was a particular fortuitous circumstance of history that the priorities came together as well as they did in the period between 1965 and 1981. Well, I should say 66 when the land freeze was implemented and 81 when the Lands Act was passed. And I think that the United States is probably going to have its self occupied with a good deal of things that are much closer to the seat of government in the next 20 years, and it would be far better served to impose institutions which we can handle it without asking the Congress for too much relief, or if we do, making it easy for the Congress to act by having our act together better at home, certainly than we had it in the past in dealing with the major legislation of the past. And I think that's about all I would like to cover at this time, having covered just about everything I can think of.
Well, thank you, Mr. Parker. When I was introducing you all, I introduced those who we were expecting, and Mr. Johnson, chairman of Bering Straits Regional Corporation and chairman of the Alaska Federation of Natives, has arrived.
Can't make them first priority and succeed. Even ARCO quits giving money to the arts when oil prices go down. And they're very honest about why they do it. They don't have any extra money to do it. They'd rather use it in their drilling program, and it's just that simple. To mention two last things in brief, one of my passions over the years, as many people here know, has been the Outer Continental Shelf Leasing Program, which, as I see it, is essentially an issue in which the federal government is pressing a relatively aggressive leasing program on the state, basically in response to an industry which wants, and understandably wants, acreage for drilling. And they will press for as much acreage as they can get. That's their job, their corporations. The federal government has generally been responsive to that, and they like the revenues that that program brings in. It's the biggest single producer revenue for the federal government except for taxes. I think the corporate structure in ANCSA has, to a large extent, affected the way in which not only the natives but the state has dealt with that issue, in the sense that alone among all the coastal areas of the United States, and by that I mean the California area, the New England area, and the sort of Florida area, and I exclude the Gulf, which is sort of a previously developed area in which offshore leasing comes somewhat comfortably, alone among all the undeveloped areas, Alaska has been singularly unsuccessful in creating any kind of a unified position, not to oppose that program, but to modify it and to moderate it and to win changes. And I think one of the reasons for that is that Alaska Natives have not been particularly unified in going to the federal government in support of a governor or in support of their own interests, simply to seek modifications which are in their interest. Almost all of the fights, including one, the first one that was made, which was really by Yakutat and Sea Alaska, have been made pretty much as a singular effort by a village or by a corporation. And I simply throw that out as a case study of the way that I think a major resource development decision for this state, and perhaps a major environmental effect on this state, and certainly a major socioeconomic effect, has essentially not been dealt with well by the natives, or I would suggest, if I may, for just a second, not dealt with in their cumulative self-interest as well as it could be because of the kind of broken-up corporate structure that they have. Finally, let me just say one thing about all of these really address Walt's paper, but one thing I think that you said in your paper is very valuable for us to keep in mind, and that is that even with the difficulties of the corporate structure, I'm obviously saying it's going to be a hard one to move away from, and maybe not even an appropriate one to move away from. I think you've done a good job in your paper pointing out the options that are still available within that structure. That is, in something as important as the land management issues, there are a wide range of trust arrangements possible which could accomplish exactly the kinds of objectives that people say they want from the reorganization under the IRA. There's the possibility of making changes in Congress or in state law which allow Native corporations to do a whole host of creative things with their land, which would solve many of the problems of alienability and speculation that you mentioned. And
conflicts of interest that the state has institutionally, which prevent it from doing a full job in the cross-cultural context. Even as an economic statute, it seems to me it should not be treated as a termination statute, and I think it would be deplorable for the Congress of the United States to allow the alienation of lands through creditors' possessions, for example, which it seems to me is a significant looming threat with respect to many Native assets. Looking for institutional protection on that, I would suggest you look at, for example, the protections that are afforded to families and individuals with respect to homestead exemptions. It seems to me that we should have some kind of protection of Native land from execution from common judgment. You can't have a cultural heritage of a lifetime being allowed to disappear because somebody got behind on a bill. On a debt. With respect to knowing everybody here wants to talk, I'll just jump to some of the solutions. Okay, well, there are a lot of people who haven't spoken. I know John Borbridge is full of ideas and wants to been criticize what others of us have said, particularly those of us that represent state or federal interests.
Well, Mr. Borbridge has been here for 3 days, and he's made a significant contribution. But you're a newcomer, and we know that
thank you.
You've got a lot to say to us and to others.
Thank you. The one in terms of the solution area, or that is the exploration of alternative institutional arrangements, which is, it seems to me, is what we're about here in these 3 days. One, it seems to me, is to look at the corporation in the larger context in which corporate law is being considered in this country generally. Some of you may be familiar with and some not. There is nothing engraved in granite about how corporations must be structured. It seems to me, to give it a context here, corporate law is part of a delegation of sovereignty by a sovereign state, to allow individuals who choose so to pick up a lawmaking function. I mean, that is the nature of private law in our society, which is based on contractual foundations, is to give to people the power to make law. And the state sets the parameters of how people are going to be allowed to make law in the context of group activity. And that group activity...
Pretty hard in Washington, D.C. to get anybody back from lunch before 2 o'clock, you know? 2:30? Of course, the other thing in Washington, D.C. is to be sufficient.
still, can you still do that or not? God, they sure did in the 60s, God.
Well, maybe we could start again, and we'll hear from Doug Jones and William Van Ness, and then from Walt Parker again, and any others seated at the table where Walt is that want to make observations or ask questions. And we've been joined this afternoon again by David Case, who is a legal advisor to the commission, and whose absence was deplored by one or two members of the panel this morning who thought he could have answered some tough questions. I should say, Mr. Havelock, that that Bill Dubay, the publisher of the Arctic Policy Review, told me that when the Emperor Constantine legalized Christianity back in the 3rd century or the 4th century, he consulted the bishops about what legal instruments should be set up to hold church land. And the emperor suggested corporations. And the bishops were concerned that the corporate model might not be suited to Christianity, that it might in some ways work to the disadvantage of Christian tendencies. But as we know, they adopted, that was the corporation's soul, I think. But he reached back even farther than you when you took us back to the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution. Well, Mr. Jones, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, am very pleased to have been invited to join in the panel, both personally, because it is fun to be with colleagues again who shared a good bit of that particular event that does gather us, but also because it's a very, very useful and commendable thing to do. Government itself typically does not look backwards and ask itself what did it think it was trying to do when it did something. There's a great deficiency, in, I think, in kind of so-called feedback mechanisms about what government had in mind when it passed a particular legislation. So it's a very, very useful thing to do. And I think this particular panel, placed in between the aspirations session and then the U.S. national policy session, is a very, very useful one to have, because it is worthwhile to inquire what were the pitfalls we thought we were trying to avoid and what were the goals we were trying to accomplish, what implementing concepts did we choose and why did we choose those as opposed to some others. Now, my own recollections of the time, just to position my own comments and remarks and participation in the matter, because I think it does help when each of us does that. Among other things, it allows you to apply whatever discount factor you want to apply for our history, each person's individual history in it. But my recollections are clearest, I think, on the matter of what were we doing, 66 to 67 and 8, in the case of the Federal Field Committee, where I served as chief economist for those years. And then, what were we doing, did we think we were doing as professional staffers, technical staffers in the United States Senate when we actually passed the bill? So it's very helpful for me to be able to have that relatively narrow, though eventful, time to make my comments about, and not really have anything necessarily very useful to say of how has it been working out and how do you go repair it if the thing needs repair. Now, in some sense, it's probably this. My own remarks are probably a little more appropriate to the aspirations session, or maybe the U.S. national policy session that follows next week. But I think there would be agreement that the matters of aspirations and then the mechanisms in the land law settlement, claim settlement, and then the matter of U.S. national policy are in a way flow together so much that whatever your participation, you're going to be talking oftentimes about the same things. Now, a couple other remarks in positioning what I have to say is it's important probably for each of us that participated at that time to try hard to avoid the mentality of vindication. You know, how was it we were as smart as we really were? Is probably not a terribly useful approach to it. But also, it's equally useful not to take a self-deprecation stance on this of, gee, how did we miss that point? How did we miss some others? How is it that the legislation turned out to be perhaps imperfect? Also, I think it's probably helpful for each of us to avoid the I was there phenomenon as best you can, because I think it's probably more helpful to the review commission if there's if all commentary and remarks are not of the storytelling variety. On the other hand, one shouldn't be too harsh about anecdotal history, because an awful lot of things that happened in with respect to this land claim settlement were not anecdotal in just a storytelling way, but that's how certain concepts were born. That's how certain propositions came about. That's how the kind of pushing and hauling and the malleability of the land claim settlement really came about. So I would not be too harsh on matter of anecdotal history, and so maybe if the panelists once in a while indulge in that, it's not too bad. Another reason for that, I think, is that recall that this was not kind of an adjudicatory matter. This was not of the traditional, if there are such things, court of claims or Indian court of claims activity, but it really was a political settlement in the best sense of small p political, by which I always mean policy settlement. It was a policy settlement. I'm not talking about smoke-filled rooms and what did Nick say to Mike and Ted and so on, but I'm talking about political settlement in the public policy sense. And so that small corner of it that I recall is what I'll want to talk about. One other caveat, if you will, if it doesn't sound too defensive, I think that it's probably also useful to try not to unduly embellish these special pleadings. I always thought that was an important goal. Now, Walt mentions in his paper, a little more specifically here, about this tricky problem of whether to alter the current arrangements as you get toward the tradability of assets and transferability of assets. And I really am not up on what the current arguments within the state are on that. I suspect there are more than two sides in talking about this. I certainly agree it's a great big subject proper for discussion and vigorous debate. And Walt mentions in his paper what seemed to me to be some notion that maybe a refederalizing would be a good idea. Now, if refederalizing means anything like I think it means, I think it's a bad idea. I think that would be unfortunate if we came this far in moving toward normalcy, what I'm calling normalcy, and in a way that is helpful to get the federal involvement to be less. It seemed to me it'd be a major setback if persons chose to so-called refederalize through some arrangement. I notice Walt uses the phrase federal communities in his paper. Well, I suspect federal communities must be awfully close to reservations. And that seemed to me that's one of the few mistakes we didn't make in public policy in Alaska, to use widespread use of federal communities arrangements. And Walt uses the very interesting phrase, relatively irrevocable, in talking about a trust. Maybe attorneys have a definition of what a relatively irrevocable trust is, but it seems to me that's an unhealthy way to go. Now, if it's true that what we teach in economics and finance courses at universities, and what I suspect is
In following your lead, Mr. Chairman, and going back a bit, certainly Western capitalism shaped the Protestant Reformation to suit its needs and provide it with the moral imperative that it needed for development. And no ongoing major social development of any scale, and viewing our own social development here as a major scale to us at least, can proceed without this happening. And in Alaska, the problem has always been in that we get a good short burst of energy underway, and then it becomes very difficult to sustain, because there is no particular Protestant Reformation to sustain it, but certainly we can certainly create something. Government is a most imperfect vehicle for the long term too, but it does need to be done. It is probably going to be the primary responsibility of the people who live in Alaska generation after generation to ensure that a solid group of them try to create that type of moral imperative which is going to make these things go forward. As Guy Martin pointed out, it is a living law. It has been from the first, and it, as I said in the paper, you have to view it in the context from right now of developing it over the next 50 years, the next two generations. The one thing, as I didn't mention that I got into in the paper, which I didn't mention in the summation, was the effect of the act on the population patterns of Alaska. I truly believe that one effect of the act is going to be generally to fix the villages in place for a much longer term than they would have been without the act. And the role of the state government is to recognize this and base its policies for the long term, that the villages will be there, whether they are the most efficient place to deliver services in the crudest type of analysis is not really the issue, because both governments have said through the act that the villages will be there in place, and they are that kind of framework on which you can build a future moral imperative that in the future social...
The place of the discovery of oil and the intrusion or the joining of other interests, those are matters that have been very well discussed. ANCSA, in effect, was sort of a compromise between, on the one hand, ancient native land rights, whose origins are traced through the historic factors that I have mentioned, and which land rights were spelled out in the use and occupancy of the lands by the natives since time immemorial. These rights collided with the institutionalized views of the members of Congress who had their